Welcome to this episode of Bioethics for the People, the most popular podcast on the planet, according to Grandma Nancy. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Tyler Gibb, who, if he weren't here recording right now, would probably be golfing.
And I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Devin Stahl, who dutifully completes the same 5 New York Times puzzles every day.
So, Tyler, do you think there's anything that humans are especially good at?
We're especially good at making poor collective decisions.
Ooh, that's a good one.
I think that people are, I don't know, I'm feeling a little bit pessimistic this morning because the weather's cold again in Michigan. So I think that nothing is going well in the world.
Yeah, and those things being correlated also seems like a very human response.
Exactly. Right, overestimating my emotions, the value and importance of my emotions. So we've got another guest today for our episode, and we're going to be talking again about AI, but a little bit different perspective. And so we've got Lucas Meyer with us. And Lucas, do you want to introduce yourself and kind of where you are in the landscape of thinking about artificial intelligence?
Yeah, hello. Thanks for having me. I'm a fellow at the Harvard Ethics Center, and I'm mainly working on algorithms that can do ethics in medicine.
So you're trying to put us out of a job.
Well, that's a prospect we might all be facing, and not that's just true. In bioethics, but yeah, in all kinds of areas.
So before we get into exactly your project, talk to us a little bit about how you got interested in AI and what your background is and what kind of tools you bring to answering this question about AI and making ethical decisions using machine learning or artificial intelligence.
Okay, so my background is in philosophy and political science, not in software engineering or computer science. But of course, AI is the big thing at the moment, and it's creeping into all kinds of, or all areas of society, basically. And in medicine, of course, it has taken root for quite a while. So there's a lot of things AI has been able to help with. So, you know, precision dosing, interpreting medical images. But what has not been done at that point was using it for ethical decision making in medicine. And, you know, as a philosopher, of course, that was the obvious interest I had.
So how do you go about then researching this topic? Did you just sit down with ChatGPT and ask it a bunch of questions and then ask your fellow ethicists some questions and see how they compared?
So at that point, ChatGPT was not around when we started. So it was shortly before that news broke, basically. So what we did was gather a small team of 4 people, a medical doctor, 2 software engineers, and myself as ethicist. And the idea was to try to sort of combine forces to develop such an algorithm. So we thought we can't solve this on a theoretical level. Other people have tried. We wanted to see whether it could be put into practice. So the question was, if we have an ethical dilemma, so for example, should patient X be switched off or should patient X be continued on life support? That's an ethical dilemma, of course. And, you know, there are many more variables to that case or to any of these cases. But if we break it down to that question, is that a question that an algorithm can solve, or is that a question that only humans can or should solve?
As you're developing this, were there particular questions that you thought were good to check against the algorithm? How did you go about thinking about what would be the right kinds of questions?
So all kinds of questions that would be put to a clinical ethics committee. That was the goal. I mean, of course, we couldn't design an algorithm that could answer any questions that would surface in a clinic. But sort of the majority of questions that a clinical ethics committee would be faced with on a day-to-day basis. So usually, as you probably know, those committees are being called in when there's sort of a problem that can't be solved between relatives, patients, and doctors of an ethical nature. And that committee would then give ethical guidance. And just as other areas of medicine have been automated, we were thinking, we were asking ourselves whether part of this domain, at least, could be automated too. So all kinds of questions that would be put to such a committee. And the algorithm was sort of supposed to mimic, you know, the mechanics of such a committee.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I think that a lot of us think of artificial intelligence or ChatGPT or large language models as we can go to them with like very specific questions or tasks and they'll be able to do things for us. But in my mind, I've always kind of assumed that those complicated, really nuanced questions that really need a lot of maybe like synthesis and creativity were just kind of outside the scope of what AI was, it was possible to do. And maybe that was a failure of imagination on my part, but how did you go about training the mm-hmm. model? Like what was the input that you were using to try to get it to start making these more complicated decisions?
Yeah, so that was sort of the challenge, right? Can artificial intelligence do that? And in a pre-ChatGPT age, without synthesizing like propositional content like sentences. So in terms of training data regarding your questions, we were considering different sources, and that was actually a bigger problem than we had thought in the beginning. So at first we were looking at court records because we thought, you know, you have a definitive answer there, which is exactly what you want if you, you know, when you want to train an algorithm. But then we of course realized that all kinds of variables play a role in court cases, and we wanted to bracket those. It should be about ethics only. That was the idea. So we couldn't use those. Then we were thinking about asking sort of people in the street for their ethical evaluations and use that as a data source to train the algorithm with. But that didn't work either because the cases in medicine are often too complex. So there are many medical variables that need to be taken into account. And usually the men in the street can't decide those properly. So in the end, we settled on case collections that were taken from like real medical ethics committees. So what was the case? What were the variables that they had to deal with in each case? You know, patient age, what does the patient want? What do the relatives want? How severe is the condition? What's the likelihood of survival? What's the quality of life of the treatment that's been proposed, and so on and so forth. And then the decisions that the clinical ethics committees reach. So those were as the ground truth of the algorithm. That was the output, and the variables I've just been mentioned were the input variables. So that was the training data set we used. I mean, to be honest, of course, in ethics, many people believe there's no right and wrong. So it's pretty tough to train an algorithm with an objectively correct data set in ethics. You can do that when it comes to image recognition. For example, you can, mm-hmm. you know, can tell the algorithm, this image contains cancer, this image does not, and then the algorithm picks that up. But you know, you can't really do that in ethics. So in a sense, what the algorithm is doing now is mimicking human decisions of these ethics committee. So they're pretty good. The algorithm is pretty good at outputting an average, in a sense, of ethical decision making. But we can't say that it's doing any objectively correct output, just as we can't say that about any human, basically. Mm-hmm.
So Lucas, where did you find these cases? Were they like in medical charts, or did you go to like the published literature?
Yeah, published literature. That's right. So anyone could access those collections. There are many books on the market. And they're mainly meant for training purposes of young medical students. So they're also good for training algorithms, actually.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that, and maybe this is how you trained it as well, but of course, if I get an ethics consult, I usually don't get enough information to render a judgment, nor would I immediately render a judgment on any particular case, just given a set of facts. Part of the role of the ethicist is to ask the right kinds of questions. So is that also something that the algorithm can do, is to, you know, get a little, if it got a case consult, it would say, well, what does the nurse think? And what information is she providing us? And have you talked to the father? And what does he have to say? Or is it kind of just synthesizing information and spitting out a potential response?
So the algorithm does ask a lot of questions, but these are hard-coded questions. So that means it would, for example, ask, what is the patient's age? And what is the likelihood of the proposed intervention succeeding? So it does ask a lot of questions, but all of these questions are hard-coded. That's the way we did it. There are other ways of doing it, of course, now that LLMs are around. So these are hard-coded questions. So that means usually the most important bases are covered. So since we got those variables from or parameters from real ethics committees, they cover the bases, basically. What they don't do is, what this collection of questions doesn't do is provide for more outlandish cases, let's say. Mm. And that's where the human factor is still much superior to any algorithmic solutions, as far as I can see, right? Because always, or often at least, humans come up with very important questions that are not standard and that flow from that specific case rather than being a collection. So that's one of the main weaknesses, I'd say, of our algorithm or any algorithm, I think, maybe bracketing LLMs because they work a little differently, but it's all hard-coded material and you only have these standardized variables. So whenever something really new or super complex comes along that's sort of not represented in the original data set, then the algorithm's performance would probably be degrading because it can't take that into account.
So before we get to what you guys found in your research project, I'm really interested in what types of challenges you had as you were training the algorithm. And I guess this comes from a question that I had from a colleague who was talking about self-driving cars. And although we don't think of it as a lot of like ethical dilemmas when you're driving a car, there's clearly like, you know, classic trolley problem type of questions that will come up for self-driving cars. And the folks who are programming and writing the code and the algorithm for these things have to make kind of morally salient questions about, you know, if the only two options are to run over five people or run over one person, like how do you work through those questions? And so was there an idea about we're going to train an AI or a software program that is kind of more utilitarian based or more consequences focused, or are there duties or other types of relationships we have to prioritize as we're educating and starting to build our algorithm?
Yeah, very good point. So that was one of the first main questions we were facing, right? Which ethical theory, moral theory should underlie the whole thing, because you need something. It needs to be based on something. Mm-hmm. So in the case of self-driving cars, there's a lot of options and there's a lot of discussion which moral system they should adopt. In our case, it was a little easier because in medicine there's sort of a de facto consensus that there are four overarching principles, and these are do no harm, benefit the patient, preference the patient's autonomy, and allocate health resources in a just manner. So these are known as the four principles invented or made popular by Beauchamp and Childress. And I mean, there are also other systems, so I'm not saying this is the only one or the best one, but it's a little dominant, in at least in Western medicine. So we could, without making too many unwarranted political assumptions, let's say, we could settle on these four principles. Now, could you have done it otherwise? Certainly. So it could have been a utilitarian algorithm. You know, utilitarianism lends itself very well to algorithmic considerations. But then, you know, one of the critiques would have been it's only after the sheer benefit of the treatment that's being proposed. What about patient autonomy here, which is sort of more like a Kantian value? And the other way around, you know, it could have been a Kantian or deontological algorithm and, you know, following patients' preferences a lot. But then, you know, you also have limited resources in a healthcare system. These are usually distributed by sort of utilitarian means. So how does that square with each other? And the four principles help sort of bridging that gap. And they're sort of a compromise solution between the two large moral systems. They're not perfect, of course. And it's still a question of how what the trade-off is supposed to be between those four principles. And, you know, there are many other assumptions. Also, they don't solve sort of the moral bedrock problems. So it's, those principles are mid-level principles. So they're applicable at the bedside, but they don't solve any issues between utilitarianism and deontology. But they're pretty good for, like, let's say, practical purposes. And that's what the algorithm was meant to be about.
All right, so let's dig in, Lucas. What did you find? How good was the algorithm?
Yes, so it was, I mean, I was very pessimistic about this project in the beginning, because first I thought, you know, is this something we should do at all? shouldn't ethics be resolved for humans and reserved for humans? And the second question was, you know, is that something we really can do? So I was pessimistic about both questions, actually. But the performance was much better than expected. So I think it was 75% accuracy, if I remember correctly, on unseen data. So cases that the algorithm had never trained with. That's pretty good for a first for a first try, right? So we were positively surprised. That's nowhere near the sort of the accuracy you'd need for clinical application, though. So that would have to be in the high 90s if you entrust human lives and actual ethical decision making to the algorithm. So, I mean, to be clear, this was a pilot project. This was just a test. Can we do this in principle? We didn't try for clinical application. And if you did that, you'd have to go to, through all kinds of processes, and the accuracy would have to be much higher. But, you know, mid-70s is pretty good. It shows that algorithms could potentially help with these things. And you could, for example, deploy software like this in areas where there's less potential for mistake, let's say. So for training purposes, for example, so young ethicists could use algorithms of this kind to sharpen their ethical intuition. They could train with the algorithm, or you could use it in emergency situation where decisions have to be made very, very quickly. You know, then maybe you're willing to trade some accuracy for speed. But in a normal clinical setting, of course, we're nowhere near the accuracy we'd need.
Yeah. So you're measuring whether or not the algorithm gave the same output as the committee, right? And judging that to be accurate or not.
That's right.
And I guess my first question is, I've been involved in a lot of committees, and I don't know that committees come to the right answer.
But when they publish them, they're always right.
Yeah, certainly, I guess. But that begs a question a little bit about what would be like an outcome that we would say that's a correct outcome versus like how are we measuring the usefulness of this algorithm?
Yeah, so that goes back to what I mentioned in the beginning, right? So that if we believe, as most people do, that there's no hard-coded right and wrong in most ethical questions, at least, then how can we say if the committees are correct, and by extension, if the algorithm that is trained on the committee's data is correct? And I think the only honest answer is we can't, because it's also you know, culture sensitive. It depends on the region. It depends on the type of training data you use. So had we only used our own ethics committee at our university hospital in Munich, for example, where we built this algorithm, then of course there would have been certain biases in the data, very likely, because it's, you know, it's a regional entity. People are from the same region. So that's why we use case collections in order to diversify in terms of location and culture. But still, that doesn't make it objective. That makes it more exclusive, a little more representative. So I think it would be an overstatement saying that we have an objective software here, or anything in ethics could be objective. So that's why the aim, as I'd formulated, is mimicking what humans do, not trying to find the right thing. And that's, of course, a big difference. But as soon as we agree that humans don't always do the right thing, the algorithm is not much worse off by sort of impersonating humans, right?
Yeah, especially if we start looking at the data about what I guess it's the accuracy of surrogate decision makers in general. I mean, it's just barely better than a flip of the coin in making decisions for other people that we know. And so maybe we're holding the AI to too high of a standard if we're looking for 90% accuracy. But
absolutely. So that's a good example. So some people are working on that too at the moment. So could algorithms, they ask, could they be better than surrogate decision makers? And yeah. So the judgment might still be out. But so that's in that case, the goal would be outperforming humans,
yeah,
if that's possible.
It also, you know, sort of prompts us to ask, like, what the point? I think you were sort of hinting at this earlier. What's the point of all this? And, you know, you might say that one of the goals, maybe the preeminent goal of a surrogate, is to make the decision that the patient would have made. And therefore, there is an objective right and wrong answer. But there might be other goods of going to a surrogate that go beyond just merely mimicking responses that the patient would have made. Because the patient might think that that surrogate making that decision is actually incredibly important, whether or not it aligns with their personal choices or what they would have chosen. And maybe with committees too, there's goods involved in people hashing out the case and thinking through the case together and asking questions together and giving a human response to a human problem might still be of value to the patients for whom that response is being given or their families. We were talking in an earlier episode about how even with diagnostics, that patients are worried about the ways in which algorithms might influence their physician. So even if they're more accurate, they don't trust them. They don't trust them as much as they trust their physician. And so that could also be true of the ethics committee, right? That there's something about the process itself that's important that couldn't be replaced by an algorithm, even if the algorithm gave a quote unquote right answer or a right kind of answer every time.
Yeah, undeniably so. So the outcome is just one of the benefits you want. So there's also benefits in the process, let's say. And of course, if you have an algorithm, there's not much of a process. The only advantage I could think of beyond speed and those more technical parameters would be that you're forced to standardize ethics because it always asks the same questions and a lot. So if you ask human members of human ethics committees, they come to decisions, but often they couldn't tell you explicitly what they were doing, actually, how that reasoning worked. So were they applying Kantian principles here? Was that a utilitarian decision? Sometimes that's sort of beyond the level of consciousness. The principles might still be at work, but they're not explicit. They're not made explicit. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but sometimes you want to know what has been going on. You want to retrace the decision. And with that, algorithms do help because they force you to standardize. But that's the only advantage, I think, sort of vis-a-vis the human factor. So I think there's no reason for canceling out the human factor as long as we can possibly afford it. So we were not suggesting that we should use this instead of ethics committees. It was a test, and it was sort of scientific interest. Can this be done? So it was not about trying to replace anything at this point. And if anything, I think ethics should be the final domain of all. That should be replaced.
Phew, job security.
Job security. I mean, yeah, that's my opinion too, but I'm completely biased about the value that I bring to any conversation. That rings true to me because when I do clinical ethics work and working with clinical ethics committees, which are usually populated by folks who are very well-read and interested and well-meaning, but just not experts in ethics, right? Experts in other things where they... rely upon the expertise of professional trained clinical ethicists to kind of help set the stage and help them understand what is really at the heart of the question that is presented to them and then chewing through that. And one of the things that I often tell them is, you know, this isn't necessarily about coming to a right answer. It's about avoiding clearly wrong answers, but then the process itself is iterative and we have these rich conversations, which sometimes folks walk out of those meetings, the only satisfaction that they get is their voice was heard and they knew that they were part of the process, which seems like completely the opposite of relegating or delegating this to that type of conversation and interaction to some sort of algorithm or AI tool.
Yeah, totally agree. It's not a replacement. There's a lot of value in the process. And I mean, that goes for sort of the main tenet of medicine, namely curing too. It's not usually just about popping a pill. It's also about the patient-doctor relation. It's about empathy. It's about being heard. Things like that. Mm-hmm. All of that algorithms, or at least non-embodied algorithms, can't do. Maybe robots can do some of that due to given the embodiment. But yeah, mm-hmm. I think we still need the human factor, clearly.
Only really cute robots delivering bad news seems like a nice... potential alternative. I'm really curious, Lucas, if you could describe like when the algorithm quote unquote got it wrong, like what kinds of answers it was giving and how wrong or bad. And it's, we always say, you know, there's maybe not a right and wrong, there's better and worse, but sometimes there really is a, it depends on the question, but sometimes there really is a wrong answer. Mm-hmm. Like if you ask it about who should be the surrogate and they give you the wrong, there are, you know, laws about this. So every now and again, there are right and wrong, or at least wrong answers. What kinds of wrong answers was the algorithm giving you?
Yeah, so absolutely. So oftentimes the borders are a little fuzzy between what's right and wrong, but sometimes it's clearly wrong. And that is usually not for ethical reasons, but for legal reasons then, if we say this is clearly wrong. And in the Western world, usually that has to do with autonomy, patient autonomy. Everything else is sort of negotiable, but patient autonomy has a very strong status, at least at the moment in bioethics, right? And at least in the Western world, there are also differences, of course, between countries. But that was the main example where the algorithm got it really wrong, namely when it was denying patient autonomy. And I'll give you the main case where we had this problem. And this was when people, for religious reasons, refuse therapies that are very beneficial in terms of outcome and extremely low risk. So from a medical perspective, there can't be any reason to refuse them. Usually those are blood transfusions, right? So very low risk, nearly zero, and would save a life if, you know, if the blood loss is great enough. And then the only variable that stands against this would be patient autonomy, namely the patient refusing the transfusion for religious reasons. And that the algorithm had a really tough time picking up. Mm-hmm. Because from the vast majority of the cases, it had learned if there's an overwhelming benefit and if the costs are overwhelmingly small, and also to the healthcare system, by the way, not just to the patient, blood transfusions are very, very cheap, then of course you should go ahead with the treatment. So that's what it had learned. So it was very confused when suddenly autonomy should carry so much weight. And we had some trouble reinforcing that behavior, because what we didn't want to do is tell the algorithm, no, you're wrong. In that case, autonomy must prevail, because that would have been a hard coding and an ethical parameter. We didn't want to do this. We wanted the algorithm to learn via cases only, because otherwise we would have had to make the ethical decisions, and we didn't want to do that. We wanted to stay clear from of that. So the way we solved this was we gave the algorithm many more cases in which patients refuse blood transfusions or other similar treatments of very low risk, and the solutions for those cases that the ethics committees had found. And then over time, the algorithm learned, okay, there's a pattern here. Patient autonomy is apparently supposed to prevail in these cases. And then over time, it learned this without us having to tell it directly. So we could still avoid this. But those are some of the pitfalls. And we hadn't thought about this at all before that problem actually occurred. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think it's so important to put these things into practice and test them. And this is also why pilot projects like this, I think, are a good thing, because you don't want this to go in the clinic for the first time.
Yeah, it reminds me of somebody said once that the four principles of medical ethics are all equal, but autonomy is the most equal among them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, yeah,
that's very well put.
And that would require, like you said, a hardwired or hard programmed prioritization of those principles, which you were obviously trying to avoid. That's really interesting.
Well, and it's not true that autonomy always trumps. And so if you had told it that, if there are other competing principles, but autonomy is one of them, autonomy always trumps, that can't always be true.
Exactly. Otherwise, it would have been easy.
Yeah.
Exactly. So we couldn't have done that.
And it's not easy. That's why we're employed. This is so cool, Lucas. Have you thought about, so I'm already thinking of like ways this would be really useful in like teaching. I think you suggested this, like if you had a, med student or a pre-med student who was trying to do bioethics for the first time and getting cases, it might be really fun to like show them what the algorithm came up with and then have them, work through it and say, oh, it didn't ask this question, or it didn't account for religious liberty, or it didn't, it'd be fun to like sort of have like test your own analysis versus this, right? I think, like you say, clinical application, not so fast, but education purposes could be really interesting. Are there other ways you've been thinking about using this algorithm you developed in teaching or in other kinds of scenarios?
We haven't been using it that way, but I think one could. So this algorithm or other algorithms, at the moment, of course, since LLMs are around, they're probably better for teaching purposes because they give you an explanation. So what our algorithm did, it's giving you a number. So that makes it pretty precise. It was not a binary output, but so the number would indicate the strength with which the algorithm recommended or not recommended the treatment. But it didn't give you any sort of description as to why that output was reached. So you could have a graphical representation and you could inspect the weights and so on and so forth, but it wouldn't give you a sentence basically, or a couple of sentences. LLMs do that, or some at least, right? So they might be better for teaching. What they don't do though is usually give you a definitive answer. Mm-hmm. And they could do that, I suppose, but they're not supposed to at the moment, or you know, some publicly available models at least are not supposed to do that. So for teaching, I think ideally you'd have both. So you give mm-hmm. you have an answer, but you also have an explanation. So combining these two would be ideal, and then you know pupils or students can discuss whether they agree with the explanation, and or whether they agree with the verdict itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine it being helpful, especially when I was learning, you know, learning ethics or studying clinical ethics. I think as somebody who was really early in my training, like I didn't know kind of what the parameters of reasonable recommendations would be. And so having some sort of, you know, not benchmarking necessarily, but a list of options, like these are all things that are kind of, you know, permissible or justifiable based upon the nuance of the case. Here are things that are clearly off the table. We're not going to do these things. But amongst these, let's have a conversation about these three or four various options. I can see it being very helpful, especially like you said, for training new folks and getting into this.
Indeed, yeah. So options on the table is very helpful as discussion points, basically. And since there's no mm-hmm. right and wrong, usually you can really have a pretty open discussion between those options. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, have list advantages and disadvantages of mm-hmm. each solution.
It strikes me that it could also be useful as the inputs change, right? So as we're, like you said, can either maybe country or region specific, you could have a, I don't know what we're calling this, an ethicist, a chatbot ethicist or an AI ethicist. You could have them maybe connected or informed or trained on particular religious minorities, for example, or regional differences, but also maybe over time. And so, you know, different prioritizing different ethical choices or ethical principles based upon the time in which those cases were developed. And I'm thinking specifically of the Henrietta Lacks case, which we hear all the time in bioethics and use as a teaching example about informed consent and about ownership of biologics after they are removed from a person. But it'd be interesting to go back and say, okay, at the time, this was the decision that was made, and here's how they justified it ethically, if they did at all, based upon the principle prioritization at that time. Whereas today we're prioritizing these other principles or these other ideas more strongly than there. And that's why it feels so unethical, but at the time, maybe it wasn't as clearly an unethical decision.
Absolutely. So it seems right to me that ethics in general, and especially clinical ethics, change according to point in time and location. So if you move across the globe, that often changes perspective or perception of ethical questions and answers. And if you go back or forth in time, it also does so. So it would be quite interesting analyzing this vis-a-vis one and the same ethical question. How does our, you know, how would our answer change? So in terms of autonomy, which we've been discussing just a few minutes ago, so autonomy has become more and more important in the Western world, right? So it was more paternalistic a couple of decades ago. Now autonomy is very strong. We might see a decline at some point again, maybe if healthcare funding declines too, and we can't fulfill all patients' wishes, things like that. So that is always in flux. So, and that's the beauty of algorithms. They can be trained with regional data, and they can be adjusted over time. You can adjust weights, you can retrain, you can update, but that's also where the dangers lie. So if you take an algorithm that was meant for one region and you just apply it in a different region, you can get catastrophic results from an ethical perspective. Or else if you receive a software update which comes with a new data set, and you know that's an outdated data set, or that data set is from the wrong regions or whatever, it could really mess things up. And that's much more dangerous than if humans are involved, because they know where they're coming from and they can discuss these things. Whereas in algorithms, it's opaque, whatever mm-hmm. is going on there. And the people who apply it, they don't necessarily know which data set is inside of the algorithm. But you could also, you could twist this and sort of reverse engineer the algorithm and use it to tease out these differences. So that was something we had contemplated, but in the end, we didn't end up doing, but maybe mm-hmm. we should have had. So rather than feeding solutions into the algorithm, we use it to sort of use it over time, and the output would not be should you proceed with a certain treatment or shouldn't you, but what has changed in terms of input variables over time. So that type of data you could also collect.
I'm thinking of like a self-driving car where you can put it on like sport mode or like economy mode. If you had it, if you're like, I'm feeling more utilitarian today, or I'm feeling, you know, my religious background is feeling more important to me today. So I'm going to amp up the utilitarian or amp down, you know, kind of a idiosyncratically adjust it in some way, or I don't know. It's super interesting.
Yeah, if you have the manpower to do that.
Yeah. I was thinking also if you, especially for training purposes of new clinical ethicists, I think one of the things I initially struggled with was asking the right questions, because you don't know what you don't know. And so in school, you're given a case and you sort of analyze it and you have an output. But really what's important in the clinical setting is learning how to ask the right questions. And so an algorithm could also like backtrack through how other clinical ethics committees made their decisions, and then start asking questions. Then you could ask of the algorithm, like, why does it want to know that? Like, why does it want to know the patient's age? Like, why would that make a difference in this case? Mm-hmm. It wouldn't in all cases. If it does in this case, why would we think it does? You know, and you could do that with all sorts of like both like those harder questions and maybe even the softer questions, like what does the patient want? What do they say they want? Maybe that's hard too. But I didn't even think to ask what the patient would have wanted. I mean, hopefully you have, but I can imagine other kinds of questions that the algorithm is asking of the user that then they would be signaled to think that that was an important, potentially important question to ask in future cases.
Yes, indeed. And you could even play around with certain variables and see what happens. So, you know, you could keep all other parameters constant about a case, for example, but you could change the patient's age from 20 to 80 and see whether that changes the outcome. We've done that, you know, just for purposes of playing around with it. And that way you can get a grip on which variables matter in which case, because they don't always do. Sometimes age is immaterial, sometimes it's very, very important. Sometimes risk is not so important, and so on and so forth. So by tweaking those variables in isolation, while keeping the rest constant as you do in a proper experiment, right? You can really get a feel for what makes or breaks an ethical decision.
I'm just imagining using a tool like this as a as a training feature, but post hoc, so after the fact. So maybe we have a committee that sees 100 cases a year or 200 cases or whatever it is, and as an annual review, we pump them all through this tool, and maybe it can identify biases or identify patterns in the types of decisions, types of recommendations that we're making that maybe we're blind to. And it's, you know, I can see that being helpful.
That's right. That's also, I mean, if something like this would ever be used in a clinic or in clinical settings, that would certainly be the way to go, I believe. So having a hybrid, so humans are still making the decisions, but maybe an algorithm runs in parallel. And if the two decisions, the algorithmic and the human made decision, if they diverge a lot by a wide margin, then maybe the ethics committee should reconsider. So things like that. Whereas if they converge, then, you know, everything's fine and we can disregard the algorithm. Sort of underlying alarming secondary process, maybe, if you will. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as we're thinking about using this tool, you know, in the future, maybe after it gets developed or maybe not, and you've been doing this research, what gives you pause? Is there anything in your research or as you've been building this or working this area that made you think, wait a second, what are we doing here? Like, maybe I need a little more caution or more thought or it's something in that regard.
So overall, I'd say it's a bit too early for these things. So we're still struggling with other domains that are much easier to resolve, or at least seem so, right? So as I said, I think ethics should be the last field we should employ it to. It doesn't mean we shouldn't, you know, try these pilot projects. And of course, you always want to be the first in science, right? You want to try it first. You want to see if that works. You want to publish it and so on and so forth. But there are many more fields in medicine that are, well, I wouldn't say in need of, but might benefit from automation. Let's do those first, and let's do ethics last.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Yeah, let's find a way for it to do my taxes, and then we can worry about
exactly. There's an abundance of tasks that annoy each and every one of us every day, And if we could solve just a few of these reliably, that would be tremendously helpful without doing much damage.
Mm-hmm. This is cool, Lucas. We'll definitely link your paper on the website so folks can check it out. But thanks for explaining it to us. This is really exciting.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Bioethics for the People. We can't do it alone, so a huge shout out to Christopher Wright for creating our theme music and to Darian Golden-Stahl for designing our logo and all of the artwork. If you're into what we're doing, give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen. And if you're really into what we're doing, head over to bioethicsforthepeople.com to snag some merch.